Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Rita Burke. I'm from Children's Hospital Los Angeles, and I am simply delighted to be moderating the session that we have for you today on gun violence and its impact on children. For this session, what we do in ICHS, we usually try to pick a topic that is very relevant to the host city. So last year in New Orleans, we did the aftermath on after Hurricane Katrina, and this year, because it is in Chicago, we decided to focus on gun violence and its impact on children. So without further ado, I would like to introduce David Hemenway. He's an economist and professor at Harvard School of Public Health and a former James Marsh visiting professor at the University of Vermont. He has received 10 Harvard Teaching Awards, and he will be speaking on using National Violent Death Reporting System to study children ages 2 to 14.
Okay, I'm going to be looking at children 2 to 14. There's no conflicts. I always want to thank the Joyce Foundation since it's been so generous to us. I'm going to talk very quickly about overall deaths to children. I was asked to do that, and then I'm going to talk about using the NVDRS to look at unintentional firearm deaths and homicides, and we're about to look at all the suicides as well. One of the things I want to emphasize in this talk is the importance of the National Violent Death Reporting System and how useful it is. We've done surveys of a lot of gun owners, and gun owners own guns, particularly handguns, and they own them for protection. Who do they own them for protection against? And the answer is strangers. And you will see that strangers are not what is dangerous to our children. And the evidence overwhelmingly, of course, indicates that a gun in the home increases the risk for children, suicides, homicides, and gun accidents. I want to make sure you understand that gun violence is a uniquely American problem, at least relative to all the developed countries. We have compared to them the most guns, particularly handguns, and the most permissive gun laws. Here's a study we just got accepted, looking at the United States versus the other high-income countries. And what it says, this is for ages 5 to 14. And what it says is that a child in the United States compared to a child in England or a child in Italy or a child in Canada or a child in Japan has a higher rate of gun homicide victimization, but it's not a little rate, a little higher. It's not 20% higher or 50% higher or twice as high. It's 18 times higher. Our gun suicide rate for 5 to 14-year-olds, this is K through 8, is 11 times higher. Our unintentional firearm death rate is 12 times higher. We are just out of the ballpark in terms of being a dangerous nation in terms of protecting our children. If you look at the 15 to 24-year-olds, who I will not talk about today, it's even worse. Our gun homicide rate is 49 times higher. It's just craziness. I teach at a school of public health, and international students cannot understand how we let this happen. What I'm going to talk about today is about children age 2 to 14, but just so you recognize, ages 0 to 14 in the United States, there are about 400 firearm deaths a year, and a lot of woundings. If you add the 15 to 19-year-olds, you're adding over 2,000 more deaths. If you add the 20 to 24-year-olds, you're adding 6,000 more deaths. What we can find is that gun deaths rise rapidly with age. The biggest problem is young adults. There's a big problem for older teenagers. And our focus, though, today is not about the biggest problem, but it's about a relatively small problem, but it's a large absolute problem. If you can look at, you know, these numbers, 78 kids, 0 to 4-year-olds per year are dying from guns, 68 5 to 9-year-olds dying from guns, 243 10 to 14-year-olds are dying from guns, and so forth. One of the things, a question was, how do you divide age groups? And we, a priori, looked at 0 to 1 years old, 2 to 4, 5 to 10, 11 to 12, and 13 to 14. And if you look at the number of deaths, it really does look like it makes sense to put 10-year-olds with the 9-year-olds and your 8-year-olds and the 7-year-olds and the 6-year-olds. And once you hit 11 and then 12 and 13 and 14, suddenly the deaths start rising rapidly. What I'm going to talk about today is all violent deaths, whether or not from guns or not, and then talk about the gun deaths. I'm going to use the National Violent Death Reporting System. The very strengths of this system, it comes from 4 data sources as opposed to 1, and that is narratives, and we read every narrative of every child death. The weakness, big weakness of this data system is that currently it's only in 32 states. 2 years ago it was only in 16 states, and those are the 16 states we can look at. We're going to look at, that's about a fourth of the population. It has about a fourth of the children, and it has about a fourth of the child gun deaths. This, just to give you a feeling, the NVDRS states are in purple. What is missing still is California, Texas, Florida, and then a lot of the Confederacy, and then a lot of the northern mountain states. And, you know, it's not a good random sample. One of the things I'm going to talk about of interest is the highest rates of violent death are for the really youngest kids in this age group, the 0 to 4-year-olds. Not necessarily the most gun deaths, but if you look at these numbers at the right, the violent death rate per million for the 0 to 1-year-olds is 172 per million, and then for the 5 to 10-year-olds it goes down to 9 per million, then it starts rising again. This is deaths. What's interesting, which I hadn't realized, is that the 11 to 14-year-olds, that there are more suicides than homicides in this age group. I know that's true nationally, but I certainly didn't think that would be true for the 11 to 14-year-olds. Looking at one of the things is that while the 0 to 4-year-olds have high homicide rates, they have very low rates of gun deaths. You don't need a gun to kill a 3-year-old. And half of all violent deaths to children aged 5 to 14 are with firearms. Firearms make it easy to kill an 8-year-old. And if you look here, you can see the percentage of overall firearm deaths on the right, even though there's a lot of deaths to children, 0 to 1 and 2 to 4, it's not usually with firearms, but about half the 5 to 14-year-olds are with firearms. And the percent of firearms, the second column of violent deaths, goes up and up and up and up and up for homicide. What I'm going to do first is talk about the unintentional firearm deaths, and we just had a paper published on this. You have to realize I listen to gun advocates a lot, and one of the things they always say is there's only 60 unintentional firearm deaths each year to children 0 to 14. I would think that's a lot, but they think that's not much. And then the other thing this crazy guy John Lott keeps saying over and over is that, quote, almost about 2/3 of accidental deaths to children are not shots fired by other little kids, but rather adult males with criminal records. Right? And I have no idea where he gets this information, but he cites it, and the Soda Gunners cite it over and over and over. And I want to show, of course, that this is wrong. First, one of the nice things about the National Violent Death Reporting System is that it's very good about unintentionals. The vital statistics are not good about unintentionals. There are actually about 80% more unintentional firearm deaths to children reported than the vitals. Why is that? Because the vitals misclassify unintentionals often as homicide. When a kid finds his dad's semi-automatic pistol, he takes out the magazine, he thinks it's unloaded. Here's a pistol without any bullets, and he pulls the trigger, and he shoots his best friend. Most medical examiners in the United States call that manslaughter. It's a homicide. In public health, we know that's an accident. You did not mean to kill your best friend. You had no intention to kill your best friend. You were not angry at your best friend. And when you put those correctly as accidents, as unintentionals, you raise the numbers by about 80%. The other thing I'll show you is that these children, who are they being killed by unintentionally? It's children. No adults. There's certainly no adults with criminal records. About 1/3 of the children are killing themselves unintentionally. About 1/3 of the children are killing other children unintentionally. About 1/6 of the time, the shooter is not a child in terms of being 14, but they're 15, 16, 17, 18, and we would consider them children. They're just older teenagers, but they're not in this group. And what's left is about 1/6, and most of the rest is by parents. And there's no sort of outside evil people shooting these people. I'll come back and show you. Mostly, our kids are shot by somebody else 2/3 of the time, except for 2 to 4-year-olds, which I didn't know until I looked at this data, and I thought I knew a lot about this. 2 to 4-year-olds have relatively high rates of accidental firearm death, and they shoot themselves. And somehow, I think that they get the gun and they point the gun at themselves, and with their little thumbs, they pull the trigger. One of the things that I've always supported is the Ask campaign, where you ask about guns at other kids' houses when your friends go there. But you should recognize that in this data set, not a single person was shot dead at a friend's house until they reached age 11. So if you have an 8-year-old, you can ask, and that's fine, but you're probably not saving her directly. You may be changing social norms, which is a good thing. And here's the data, which you can look at quickly. Deaths per million years, it goes from 0.4, then suddenly to the 2 to 4-year-olds are 4 times higher, and then it goes sort of back a little for the 5 to 10-year-olds. And you see the percent on other inflicted, it's 67% or more for every age group except for the 2 to 4-year-olds, and there it's less than 30%. Because the 2 to 4-year-olds are shooting themselves. One of the things we then to look at is, of interest, who is shooting these kids, and it's males. If you look at these the 2/3 of the deaths which are under other inflicted, it's all males are the shooters. It's almost all family or friends, and if it's family, basically, it's the brother, and if it's not the younger brother, it's the older brother. And you can see sort of the numbers here. Percent male, 97% of other inflicted deaths to these children are men. There's not, women. You can look at the family numbers. Percent family starts with 100% and then goes down to 24%. Friends start at 0%, go up to 56%. So your 13 to 14-year-old is going to be killed by a friend. Younger is being killed by somebody in the family, typically the older brother. I'm going to talk about homicides. There's probably too much stuff here, but let's talk about homicides. We had done a study about homicides of 0 to 1-year-olds, and so we're not going to talk about that. And what we found is, again, a big, big homicide rate, almost never used guns. The most common homicide perpetrator was the boyfriend of the mom. And so the intervention which we were taught, which is teach the moms about the purple period of crying, this doesn't seem to be directly related to the problem. When we look at the 2 to 14-year-olds, we find that mostly they're being killed by family or caretakers through the age of 4. There's very few strangers, but there are unknowns. And I can't show you this, but a sizable majority of homicides are gun homicides after age 10, even for family caretaker homicides, and you can see this. About a quarter of all child homicides are by the dad or stepdad. About a half of all homicides by the dad are murder-suicides, so this is really common. In the murder-suicides, the dads almost always use guns, and what's not shown is that in the sizable majority of murder-suicides, the dad kills the children and the mom. And the mom's boyfriend is no longer a problem at all, basically after age 4. Moms also kill occasionally in terms of murder-suicide, but they never kill the dad. In conclusion, who is killing children in the United States? Unintentional firearm fatalities, it's children killing children. Suicide, it's children killing themselves. Homicide for younger children, it's parents and caretakers. And for the older, the 10 to 14-year-olds, it's also parents and it's acquaintances. And then there's a lot of unknowns. These 13 to 14-year-olds are killed outside the home, and nobody quite has a good way. So let me stop. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Hemingway. Our next speaker is Rebecca Levin. She's the Strategic Director of the Injury Prevention and Research Center at Ann and Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago, where she directs the Strengthening Chicago's Youth Violence Prevention Collaborative. Her topic is Community Strategies for Prevention in Chicago.
Thank you. Nothing to disclose. So I was also asked to share just a little bit of data about the violence problem in Chicago. So just to start out, who here is from Chicago? Great. And who, even if you aren't from Chicago, you've heard something about violence in Chicago? Yeah, so it's something that gets a pretty large amount of attention. So between 2013 and 2014, which of the following do you think happened in Chicago? The number of homicides and the number of shootings both increased. So who thinks that A is the correct answer? All right, who thinks that the number of homicides and the number of shootings both decreased? Okay. Who thinks the number of homicides increased and the number of shootings decreased? Okay, and who thinks the number of homicides decreased and the number of shootings increased? Okay, so you guys are correct. The answer is D, so that most of you got that right. So this is puzzling to me from a public health perspective. It doesn't give me much to go on. If I was looking at a longer period of time, like if that was the case over, say, 20 years, I might attribute it to better medical care. But over a period of a single year, I don't really know what to do with that. So let's look at another one. So, you know, you see in the headlines, the media will refer to Chicago as the murder capital of the U.S. or Chirac. So why is this? Who thinks it's because Chicago has the highest homicide rate in the U.S.? All right, who thinks it's because Chicago has the highest number of homicides in the U.S.? And who thinks it's both, that Chicago has both the highest homicide rate and the highest number of homicides in the U.S.? Okay, this is what I like about talking to a public health audience. You guys know the answer to this one, right? Chicago has the highest number of homicides in the U.S. We're also the third largest city in the country. So New York and L.A. have done a much better job of bringing down the number of homicides. So we do outpace them in terms of the number of homicides. But if we look at homicide rate in the U.S., we usually fall about 20th highest in the country. So despite the headlines and the public perception, we aren't really the murder capital of the U.S. By most measures. So let's just highlight a couple other data points here. I'm not going to emphasize everything on this slide. You can look at it yourself. But I wanted to emphasize, so we had 407 homicides last year. This is a 57% decline from our highest number of homicides in 1992. Last year we were at the lowest number of homicides since 1965. Right? This is an amazing public health success story. We've been doing a great job. Not that there's not more that we can do. There certainly is. But this part of the story doesn't get told very much. Year to date, we are up about 19% over last year. Shootings, similar sorts of numbers. Because we're focused today, and some of the other speakers will talk about firearms, I did want to emphasize that firearms are becoming a larger proportion of the homicide problem in Chicago. So in 1991, 69% of the homicides were committed with guns, and we're up to over 80% of the homicides being committed with guns. And the victims and the offenders both skew young. So every year from 91 to 2011, the highest number of victims were in the 17 to 25-year-old age group, and the majority of the offenders were 25 or younger. So if the number of homicides was the lowest since 1965, why do we capture this national attention? And why do so many Chicagoans feel unsafe in their own communities? Well, there's still this enormous disparity problem. So while the city as a whole has gotten much safer, there are pockets of the city that have gotten more dangerous. So this looks at the change in homicide rate over the last 20 years. It's taken from a blogger who's done a lot of work looking at neighborhood-level data in Chicago. And so the green communities are communities that have seen a decrease in homicide rate. And the darker green, the larger the decrease. So up in the far northeast corner of the city, that's Rogers Park. And that community has experienced about an 83% decrease in homicide rate over the last 20 years. The red communities are communities that have experienced increase in homicide. And they all have one thing in common. All of those communities are, the vast majority of the population is African American. So in 2009, in the fall of 2009, the national spotlight really was focused in on Chicago and our violence. A Fenger High School honor student named Darren Albert, a 16-year-old student, was beaten to death outside of his high school. The murder was video recorded, right? And the video went viral. And all of a sudden you had this national and international spotlight on Chicago. And the hospital, now it's called Anna Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago. At the time, it was called Children's Memorial Hospital. We're this leading institution looking out for kids in Chicago. For those of you who are from Chicago, you've all seen the billboards. You all know us as the place where kids come first. And so the folks at the hospital, I wasn't there at the time, but Karen Sheehan, one of our pediatricians, was there at the time. She's in the audience today. So the folks like Karen, other clinicians, social workers, researchers came together and said, what are we going to do about this? Talked to stakeholders from the community over the course of a couple years, and ended up developing a violence prevention collaborative called Strengthening Chicago's Youth, or SCI. And what we do with SCI is take a public health approach to violence prevention. Now, the idea of a public health approach to violence prevention has gotten a lot of buzz in Chicago recently, but there's a lot of misunderstanding. Most people who say public health approach to violence prevention, when we're having a discussion about this in Chicago, mean one of two things. So one is that they only mean primary prevention. And they aren't thinking about secondary or tertiary prevention. They aren't thinking about responding to violence. The other, and this is probably a more common misperception, is that public health is described as the opposite of a law enforcement or criminal justice approach. So we really try to emphasize that public health is about connecting different stakeholders. So there's work that's been done by the CDC with their STRIVE initiative, Striving to Reduce Youth Violence Everywhere, that emphasizes three components of a public health approach to violence. The first is consistent messaging about the preventability of violence. If you pick up the paper on a Monday morning in Chicago, you get the idea that violence is just inevitable. Then on a Monday morning, you are going to pick up the paper and you are going to read how many people were shot or killed over the weekend. That's not something that we need to accept as fact. There are things that can be done to prevent violence. So the second piece of this public health approach is the idea that there are evidence-based strategies. There's a lot of science that has been done over the last 20 to 30 years that shows us what works to prevent violence, and we should be deploying that. The third piece of that is that requires a multi-sector approach. It requires each of us collaborating and doing our part to prevent violence. We've also done work because violence prevention is a very amorphous concept. If I say to a policymaker, I want to prevent violence, and I want you to invest in violence prevention, they're probably going to go back to thinking about this law enforcement and criminal justice idea, right? A policymaker is probably going to default to, okay, let's put more cops on the street. For a parent, if I say there are things you should be doing within your family to prevent violence, that doesn't really give them anything to go on. So we've developed this call to action that we call our Focus on Five, where we've emphasized five component parts of what we mean by violence prevention. And the other thing that happens a lot when policymakers in particular talk about this is that they default to talking just about the gun. And I'll talk about that in a second. We do see that as part of this. But there is a reason why we have five component parts, not just the focus on the fire. So the first is sustained investment in children and youth. There are things that we can be, there are policies that we can be investing in, right? High-quality early childhood education, early childhood home visitation, good quality schools, after-school programs, mentoring programs. There are so many things that we know work to support children and youth and their families. And in Chicago and Illinois in particular, we really emphasize that sustained piece. We have a lousy track record of trying something out for a year, 18 months, 2 years, and then saying, oh, wait, we haven't solved our violence problem. Let's move on to the next new thing. So we really are emphasizing the need for sustained investment. And then there are things that we provide guidance to parents on what they can do to be supporting their children and youth and really how families can invest in their own kids. The second is equitable access to high-quality mental health services. So certainly in Chicago, in Illinois, and the nation, we've really undermined our mental health system. And it's not that it's... A lot of times when we're talking just about gun policy, the issue of mental health gets kind of conflated when we're talking about, say, mass shootings and what the role of mental health is in that. But for young people growing up in Chicago, for families raising their children in Chicago, the toll that's taken by the violence, by the economic deprivation, by the increasing isolation of communities, this all takes a toll on mental health. We have a generation of children who are, the mental health symptoms that they exhibit are similar to those experienced by war veterans, right? So we have children who are showing signs of PTSD, and we need a system that can handle that. So common sense approaches to gun violence prevention. If you waved a magic wand and got rid of all the guns in Chicago tomorrow, we wouldn't solve our violence problem, but we would certainly make it far less lethal. And so there are things that we can be doing to get, in particular, illegal guns off the street and be working on our gun trafficking problem in Chicago. So Chicago Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy likes to talk about how Chicago recovers 7 times more illegal crime guns per capita than New York does, and then likes to say, and our gun homicide rate is 7 times higher. I haven't done the math to see how true that is, but certainly we recover a lot more crime guns. There's something going on with gun trafficking in Chicago, and we sit kind of at this intersection of 3 different states where Indiana in particular has looser gun laws. We get a lot of crime guns coming from Wisconsin, a lot of crime guns coming from Mississippi. We have, despite the reputation of having the nation's strong gun laws, there are a lot of gaps in Illinois gun policy. So this is an important area to be addressing. A juvenile justice system that reflects what we know about adolescent development. The juvenile justice system was actually founded in Cook County by Jane Addams. Now, 115 years ago, she didn't talk about brain science, but really that's what she meant, that the adolescent brain is not fully developed. And so young people who are involved in the justice system, this is an opportunity to intervene and do a course correction, get a young person back on a positive path by providing them with the support and services that they need. So there are reforms we can make to the juvenile justice system to better support our young people. And the last is sustained investment in strong communities. So we know that communities that are more tightly knit, that have more social cohesion, that have more collective efficacy, are safer, even when you control for poverty. So there are things that we can do to invest in that social fabric. And part of it is ending policies that further isolate communities and that promote disinvestment. So those are the 5 things that we say make up violence prevention. If you would like to connect with us, since that is our primary role as a connector, please feel free to do so. Here is our information. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Roz Pesci. He's a school and clinical psychologist and school psychology coordinator of clinical training at Loyola University Chicago. His talk is titled School-Based Prevention Strategies in Chicago.
Thank you for having me. I see myself more as a practitioner, having practiced for 32 years in the Cicero Berwyn community and been at Loyola for only 8 years. But I'm here to talk about how schools can become involved in some effective gang prevention. Just a few slides that basically I think we've all seen that gangs are a problem across the country, and they do manifest themselves in schools. The next slide will show you a national survey that shows the amount of students that say they have been affected by gangs, and then you add substance abuse as well, and it complicates the picture, as we know. There are some risk factors that might be harder for schools to address, especially the family and the individual risk factors. Our best attempt would be to connect families with some agencies that work in the area. However, when we get into the peer group, we might have more control in terms of what we're able to do at school. And in our case, we bridged some great relationships with some community agencies to address the problem. And finally, there are certainly direct things we can do at school in terms of quality of instruction, school climate, our discipline rules, consequences, teacher-student ratios, et cetera, et cetera. So this is where we came into the picture. We had a crisis in 1996, a student was shot outside of one of our two campuses in Berwyn, and suddenly the community was in arms over gang issues. The school board decided to put together a safe school plan, which included over 20 points for us to address. At the time, I was the student assistance program coordinator, and I was asked to be the coordinator of two community-based violence prevention task forces that were to be held at each campus. I was the coordinator, but the official chairs were the principals of each school, along with the town representative. The mayor of Berwyn actually was on it at West, and we had a trustee for Cicero. Before I go any further, many of you are familiar with the community. Cicero has never made any bones about hiding the fact that they've had gang problems dating back to Al Capone. And as you know, some of their higher level officials have actually served federal time because of the problem as well. But regardless, the agencies that have worked in the community have been very dedicated to dealing with this problem. More on the community demographics right now as they stand. About 93% low income, 10% English learners, 30% chronic truants, 8% identified with disabilities, 1% homeless, and a graduation rate of 70%. We took a public health approach as we looked at what we did in our school. We had, now we call it, I don't know, those of you that work with schools know what the three tiers are. We work a three-tier model with tier one being universal, hoping to affect 80 to 90% of our student population, tier two, 5 to 10%, tier three, 1 to 5%. So the gang prevention program that we initiated would have falls nicely under tier two. So we acknowledged that there was a problem. We wanted to involve law enforcement right from the start. We did a needs assessment, and we decided to use in-school resources. We used people like psychologists, social workers, counselors, teachers, aides to help deliver the program, and we used a lot of data to drive our decisions. We took a look at the goals and objectives of our lessons for the first two times we ran the program to make sure we were meeting our goals and objectives. We also did exit interviews to get feedback from the students. So this is how it worked. If a student committed an offense in school that was usually suspendable, they could opt to be in this program instead. They met once a week for first five lessons, and then we expanded the lessons that we had in the program based on data we got from the students. And we had two field trips, a graduation ceremony that included community agencies that were committed to working with families that are impacted by gangs. And the most important part of the program, the students who graduated were then encouraged to be part of a support group that met weekly at the school during the school day until they graduated. And so that was the hook. That was the connectedness that we established with these high-risk youth. And data will show that that's one of the best ways to prevent gang involvement. So the original five lessons are on the left side. We added conflict resolution, family and peers getting out, developing a plan later on. The program stopped running for a while and was reinstated a few years ago at the Morton Freshman Center, and we substituted some of the lessons with new ones on bullying, cyberbullying, job searching, applications, and snitching and reporting, which is a real problem, right? The crisis of silence in the neighborhood. And the other thing you need to know is we used to have former gang members present at two lessons, the one on getting out of a gang and the one on second chances. Ceasefire came into our community, Cicero Ceasefire, in 2005, and we started getting them involved with our program to help teach the lessons and do some casework with some of our students in the school and out in the community. There you just see some basic data from one of our early cohorts, after 2 years, you see the number of students that were still enrolled or graduated in the control group 1 versus 9. And in some cases, we actually recommended that students go to Lincoln's Challenge, which is a military-based alternative program where students can get their GED, and we would have people from our school say that they would be their mentors, because that's an important part of the program. Again, we ran another study 2 years later, and you see the comparable results. 4 were still enrolled or graduated versus 8 that were GAIN graduates. Later on, because of population shifts, we had to build a new campus, a freshman center. And so that houses 1,300 students. We decided to run the program only with the freshmen before it was open to any year of school. And that study would be the 2005 study, the blue lines. And as you could see, again, higher rates of remaining in school versus dropping out for students that were in the freshman cohort. As you heard me say, we used ceasefire workers to help us with some lessons, but then we also became more involved in the community through the Cicero Youth Task Force, started in 2003. It's one of those community organizations or collaborations that Becky kind of alluded to. We currently have 200 partners in it, and we've brought in $13 million worth of grants since the time it started. And we've used these ceasefire workers to assist us on the safety committee. They helped create and implement a gang study we did in 2008. And we just finished another community safety survey focus group data collection process that they assisted us with in 2013. The results of that study target a certain part of our town, the northeast section of the town around Roosevelt and Cicero Avenue, where we're going to try to reestablish Neighborhood Watch the way it was supposed to be established and carried out. I don't know how much you know about ceasefire, but basically they're street workers. They have various roles. They have violence interrupters that actually go through the streets and try to defuse situations. They have other people called caseworkers. They work more directly with the youth. And in our case, they work with the youth in school, out on the street, as they get older, help them find jobs, et cetera, et cetera. In contrast to the tug between law enforcement and public health, I can say that the police work extremely closely with the ceasefire workers. There's a lot of trust, and that's made a difference in the community. In fact, when we hire new ceasefire workers, the police force, the head of the police department, now the gang tactical unit head, is part of the hiring panel that decides whether or not this person should be on the team. And again, there's their model. And so changing behaviors and norms fits in well with the mission of the Cicero Youth Task Force. And just a little data behind ceasefire, it is rated a level 2 program by the U.S. Department of Justice Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. So it has been found effective when it's carried out with integrity. These are some statistics from our last few cohorts from the Freshman Center. Here these students would not be able to graduate yet. They're still in school, but you can see we're looking at the number of classes passed right when they were in the program in fall 2012 and then following them in spring. And classes failed consistently. So the students that were in the program seemed to get more connected with school and stay connected with school. And finally, the most powerful statistics you're going to see, again, this is the second group, the last one that started, again, passing versus non-passing. And here you see dramatically the number of homicides and shootings that have dropped over the time from 2006 to 2015. Obviously, one shooting is one too many, but the numbers show that something is going right in the community in terms of getting the youth, getting the community, and getting some workers out on the street that work closely with the police to make some change. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Elena Quintana. She is the Executive Director of the Institute on Public Safety and Social Justice at the Adler School of Professional Psychology. Her talk is titled Criminal Justice and Youth Violence Prevention.
Hi, everybody. I really want to focus in not on criminal justice as it relates to, like, the parents of the toddlers that are killing themselves or others. I wanted to focus in on what people think of when they think of youth violence. And I brought this picture. I use this a lot in training because criminal justice is not scientific. It's largely based upon what makes us emotional. And when you see this picture, it's scary. These are people that have been dehumanized. I mean, most people who see this, they're like, you know, there's a weapon in the picture. They're look like three young males with a weapon. You might not want to go, you know, in this area, right? And so there's a lot of fear. These people look young to me. I mean, these maybe look like some teenagers, right? And so when I see this, a lot of what's driven in criminal justice is driven by our first reactions to this picture, right? And the ability to dehumanize people like this. So I wanted to focus on that and on on the fact that basically about 10% of homicides are done by people under 18, so it's not the hugest percentage. And also the juveniles that commit murder are often incredibly traumatized. And I think that childhood trauma is something that's coming more to the fore in criminal justice thought, but it's really slow to catch up with our policy. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that because I think that childhood trauma is really the common denominator for both victims and perpetrators of violence. And I'm not talking about unintended injury. I'm talking about community violence and what we see more here in Chicago around for, like, older adolescents, older teenagers, outside the range of the younger kids, right? As Becky talked about earlier, you know, with Jane Addams talking about brain development and that sort of thing, I really go to the work of, this is Laura Porter's work on adverse childhood experiences, talking about how lots of negative things can affect brain development, and I don't just want to concentrate on the negative things, like when there are, for example, when there are benefits, you know, there's resources and positive caring relationships, that these things can ameliorate these effects. So it's not just a negative story. We need to think about what we can do to actually, treat trauma in a way that's more positive than just the criminal justice system, which I will talk about in a moment. To further talk about trauma that take place in critical periods of brain development, it can produce behavioral outcomes directly related to the time and type of injury. For example, for those who experience, like, who witness violence or who've experienced sexual abuse as adolescents, as you can imagine, this is like a huge, like, number of young people, their cortex may be affected which could result in impulsiveness, diminished hope, diminished reasoning, and basically inferior executive functioning. These are all things you don't want around weapons, let's say. So how do you think the criminal justice system affects a traumatized child's brain? If we're really thinking about what is really helpful in terms of it, I'll start with some stats. And, you know, in terms of what's happened with the criminal justice system, it's not equal for everybody. And trying, you know, we do things like we try youth as adults as early as 13 years old. Did I just skip a whole bunch of pictures? Oh, sorry. Okay, so we, yeah, try youth as adults as young as 13 years of age. We put firearm enhancements on them, gang enhancements. We target young people of color in arrest, prosecution, with disproportionate sentencing, so that basically youth of color get arrested more, charged for more serious crimes that lead to longer sentencing. And this is particularly around gun violence in a place where guns are incredibly available and easy to use and highly lethal. So the greatest predictor of whether or not a person will go to prison is if they were locked up as a child. This is Mel Bernstein's work. So let's talk about why do young people even shoot, right? Or why do they carry guns? And when I worked with, like, many, many, many young people in the juvenile detention center and in communities who carry weapons, and I ask, and without fail, if I say, why are you carrying a gun? Or why did you get caught with a weapon? And they will always use the same two words in response. They'll say, for protection. People who do not feel safe carry weapons. And I think that we predicate the right to bear arms around that, right? And so we are surprised when people who are not particularly well protected carry weapons, including our young people. So I think that we need to really question whether young people of color should feel safe and protected by the criminal justice system when youth of color are arrested and detained more frequently than white youth and are given harsher sentences. There's lots of data around implicit bias. We had two high schools. I know that Becky talked about Fanger High School where Darian Albert was killed. What's interesting is there was another high school, it was Lyons Township, I might be wrong, but it was a suburban high school where literally almost the same thing happened with a bunch of white students. Nobody served any jail time. And in Fanger High School, we had kids, you know, there was one kid who was 14 years old who got in one good punch to Darian Albert, who sadly later perished in that fight, but that kid was given a 30-year sentence. Right, so this is the kind of disproportionality that I'm talking about that's really harms, and like all of this stuff brings to bear a lot of kind of opinion and, you know, litigation and lawmaking, all these statutes that affect gun laws and behavior with guns, with weapons. And so I think that we need to really kind of put on the brakes and start thinking, are we treating our kids as precious, or are we treating them as predators? And if we treat them as predators, what does that do for them? So there's a distance now between what we know and what we do. Like, what we do know is that young people have a greater capacity to change than adults do, that youth are worse off for any contact with the juvenile justice system, or especially the adult system as well, if they're tried as adults. Young people who engage in serious criminal acts can go on to live peaceful lives in the mainstream if they get the kind of treatment that they need. Like, young people have a great capacity for change, right? And that victims of violence are given an option to go through a restorative process, are more satisfied, and have a greater sense of resolution than those who do not. I want to make a little commercial here for the power of restorative justice, which is a philosophy with a bunch of practices related to it that restore people to their highest form of functioning within community. It repairs harm through relationship building. And this is not just for very small offenses. It can also be where the harm is very great, like in violent offenses. So I think it's important when we think about the state of juvenile justice that there's no benefit. There's no benefit to public safety to try juveniles as adults. I think I said that before. Many are abused in custody, given extended lengths of imprisonment, including solitary confinement. There's no consideration for brain science, recreating rather than addressing existing trauma. And there's an almost 5 times greater reoffense rate. Many states and cities have divested in mental health, recreation, and educational programs where mass incarceration is most concentrated. So I think it's really important to show how when you divest in a community because you're like taking half of the parents out and sending them away to prison, it really ends up making communities less safe. And then restorative justice practices are uncommon, particularly for more serious offenses, but they actually show really great results in terms of people's satisfaction in using them, especially for people who have been harmed. I want to talk a little bit about historical trauma as well. I think I talked about this in terms of what's been happening, particularly with our relationship with the police, that we need to stop police practices that re-traumatize communities and hurt positive relationships between first responders and communities. Communities that invest heavily in repairing relationships with law enforcement, you know, enjoy much better response rates, communication back and forth, and level of trust that increases public safety. One of the kind of hallmarks about what's going on in the United States is the existence of juvenile life without parole. And juvenile life without parole is banned in the UN in terms of the Convention of the Rights of the Child. And this slide is actually wrong because it says it's been ratified by every country in the world except two, Somalia and the United States, but Somalia ratified it in January of this year. So now we are alone. Yes. And in the U.S., there are about 2,500 as of 2008 of juveniles who have been given life without parole. I see many of them, actually, not a huge number, but a fair number of juveniles who not only have been given life without parole or who have been given very long sentences, 50 or 60 year sentences. There is hope that a number of states are basically eliminating juvenile life without parole. But I want to, you know, I'm excited when the people that I see that are locked up, they are really working on ways to address trauma with each other and to think about their own potential to change, even if they're going to be locked up for extended periods of time. I work in Danville Correctional Center once a month with a group of prisoners that were all arrested for murder between the ages of 15 and 17. They are the most incredible scholars I have ever had the pleasure of working with. They're amazing. And all of these people say, you know, we're going to be locked up basically for all of our lives, and we want to do something for these short-timers who come in here and leave and come in here and leave. And so they started a trauma-informed group called the Community Anti-Violence Education Program. That's a trauma-informed way to address the way that trauma has affected your life and your perception and your reactions, so that when these people go back out into the world, these old-timers will have invested them with this curriculum that they've tailored. It's one by Sandra Bloom, who is, she's done lots of trauma work. And it was specifically created for gunshot wound victims in Philadelphia. And now it's being applied as a peer-led program within Danville Correctional Institution. And it just shows that people really want to heal. When people engage in the justice process, they want to heal. But we don't allow for that healing, and we especially need to allow for that healing in children. So, just to recap, an overall public health approach to addressing gun violence would really look at, we would really support greater gun control efforts. We would use police buying power to lobby for fingerprint locks, automatic gun locks, that sort of thing. We just had a big group of police here last week or something, a couple weeks ago, that they really were talking about how they could use their buying power in that way to kind of sway gun lobbies to use fingerprint locks, which would be helpful. Universal background checks, restrictions on secondary sales of guns, that's been somewhat helpful in some places to stop illegal purchasing of guns. Promoting positive relationship opportunities with caring adults, that's connected to the ceasefire work, as well as addressing poverty and opportunity and income gaps. Huge. So I say all this to revisit these young people, these young dehumanized people, to urge you to see something different in them, so that we can actually start treating the actual root causes and connecting with each other, because without that connection, we are not going to get the healing that we need.
And our last speaker of the last session is Dr. Eric Fliegler. He's a pediatric emergency physician at Boston Children's Hospital and assistant professor in pediatrics and emergency medicine at Harvard Medical School. His talk is entitled Legislative and Clinical Approaches to Decreasing Firearm Injury.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for being with us on the last day towards the end of the this conference. I have no disclosures. So my goal today is to talk really about two elements. One, to evaluate some of the legislative approaches to decreasing firearm violence. I'm going to talk both about some positive and negative studies related to this, and specifically talk about some of the challenges to research. I'll put this in the context that I'm working with a group of other pediatric emergency physicians where we're doing an exhaustive review of every single research article related to firearm legislation and homicide, and I'm trying to distill this down to some of the key ones. The second objective is I'm going to be reviewing some clinical interventions to decrease unsafe exposure to firearms. First, you know, we've talked a lot about epidemiology, and I'll take one last kind of stab at this. What this chart shows you are fatalities in the United States specifically related to violence. So although it's hard to read, on the x-axis, those are ages. So on the left is the infants, and on the right are people the end of life and 80 years or older. And on the y-axis are the percent of deaths associated with violence. And what you'll notice is that there's this huge, huge peak in the middle. So between the ages of 15 to 26, or 29, excuse me, you'll see that anywhere from a quarter to a third of all fatalities are related to violence. And when you distill it down to firearms, and you look at this group, 15 to 29-year-olds, one in five, 20% of the deaths in this age group are related to firearms. It's kind of a stunning number if you think about it. And if we were to consider this across any other method of death, pneumonias, cancer, we would find this outrageous, and yet we don't do a lot about this. So let's dive into firearm legislation. Classically, firearm legislation is divided into five major categories. I give credit to the Brady Center as kind of separating them into these five categories. They include curbing firearm trafficking, which there are nine different types of laws, which are basically about how firearm dealers are registered and how they have to maintain their records, and there's a lot of variability in this. There are laws related to background checks. Of course, the most common is the Brady background check. But there are also about laws related to how gun shows can be regulated, permits to purchase guns, permits to purchase ammunition. There are child safety laws, which could include laws related to trigger locks, safe storage of guns, setting age limits. Remarkably, there are many states where there are essentially no age limits on when you can purchase a gun. There are laws related to assault weapons, classically the military-style weapons and large ammunition clips. And then laws related to guns in public places. Traditionally, these guns have been outlawed in public places, but these are actually laws about whether they do or do not allow this. But the truth is there actually is a lot more legislation and regulation, not just laws, but regulations that could or could not be applied to firearms. So one is mandatory sentences for crimes that involve firearms, and I'm going to talk about an article that looks at this interesting topic. I mentioned already the idea of laws behind open carry and concealed weapons in public places, and it should be noted that since Sandy Hook occurred, the vast majority of laws in the United States related to firearms have been allowing more firearms in public places. That's where the concentration of laws have been passed in the last few years. There have been prohibitions on patient-provider communication. Starting in 2011, Florida passed the first law that prohibits doctors from talking to patients about guns, and two other states have already passed laws related to that, and about nearly a dozen others have attempted. There's a lack of consumer regulation. Remarkably, there are essentially no regulations whatsoever related to firearms. David mentioned earlier that there are 110 accidental deaths related to kids killing themselves with guns. The Tacoma company that has the airbags that are faulty. Can anybody tell me how many people have died from those faulty airbags? Anybody? Two. Two people have died. 129 have been injured related to it. And yet it is the largest recall in the world ever related to this. And over 100 people every year are dying because there's no regulations for guns. Limitations on databases. There are essentially very few databases related to anything related to firearms, including there's a destruction of background check data within 24 hours of it occurring to prevent people from studying and understanding this. There's an inability to prosecute dealers who sell the guns, and they know that there's a very small number of dealers who are selling the majority of guns related to crimes. The gun show loopholes, which are famous, that anybody can sell guns in most states. And then, of course, there's a lack of research funding. In 1996, Congress passed laws that banned the CDC, and then NIH, and then Health and Human Services from funding any research related to firearms. So let me take a dive into a couple of studies. So this first one is called Safe Gun Storage Laws and Child Mortality Due to Firearms. And in 1989, Florida, passed laws that encouraged firearm safe storage in households of children less than 16 years of age. What does that mean by encourage? It wasn't so much that it mandated, but it said there will be a prosecution if a problem occurs. And specifically, if a child was injured or a fatality occurs, he could be prosecuted. Over the next 4 years, 11 other states passed these types of laws that required either lock boxes or trigger locks. It was a felony in Florida, Connecticut, and California, and in the other states, it was a misdemeanor. So a study was done. So this involved 16 years of study. During this time, there were 11,918 deaths in the U.S. Due to firearms in children less than 15 years of age. Again, almost 12,000 young children dying. Roughly a third were unintentional. Little less than a quarter, than 20% were suicides, and nearly half of these were homicides. And David's already gone over the distribution by age. So here's what they found. In the states that had passed these laws, afterwards, the fatality rates by unintentional had dropped to an incident rate ratio of 0.77. In other words, a 23% decrease in fatalities, statistically significant. Both suicides and homicides had also dropped. They didn't quite reach statistical significance. However, it needs to be understood that most of the laws that were being studied were before, the time was before the legislation. It was 156 years of laws across all these states, and only 36 years post. I think if you had continued this analysis, you would see that this holds across all of them. The most striking difference within the young children, and kids who are less than 10 years of age, it was a 40% reduction. That is a massive reduction. Think about all the interventions in public health we try to do. A 40% reduction would be amazing. They also found that in states that had the felonies, it was the greatest reduction as opposed to ones where it's a misdemeanor. So when it was a real law that had real meaning, families changed their behaviors and it led to less deaths. I think that's a key thing to take away. All right, next study we're going to look at. Firearms decrease role in New Jersey homicides after a mandatory sentencing law. So in 1981, New Jersey passed what was called the Graves Amendment. And this refers to mandatory imprisonment without parole if in a possession of a firearm during a crime. It didn't talk about the length of the sentence, but how long they would absolutely have to stay in jail if they used a firearm during a crime, as opposed to getting the option of getting some sort of parole early on. And what they decided to look at was they measured violent crimes that have a gun present or not. And the idea was, they said, listen, we don't have a huge number of fatalities or injuries because of this, and so we're not going to study that. They realized up front, you have to be very careful about what you study if you want to be able to understand if you made a difference. And here's what they found. So on the left, that's homicides due to firearms, and on the right are suicides. So let's look at the homicides first. So the x-axis, again, is year 1974 to 1986, the percent of firearms that were present in a homicide. The black dots are New Jersey, and the white dots are U.S. And this is a study that did a beautiful job of understanding you need to look at secular trends, what's happening in the whole country compared to this state. So when you look at the United States, first you notice there was kind of a general consistent trend downward, which is good. Not a huge trend. It was still quite high. Over about 65% of homicides involved guns in the United States, but it was going down. In New Jersey, before this law was passed, it was actually an upward trend. There was a slight increase. And when they passed this law, very quickly, you see a precipitous drop. And so this slope, this change in this, was pretty significant. So though it decreased both the United States and New Jersey, it was a really major change. Now, what they did to control for this is they looked at suicides. You would not expect this to have affected suicide rates. And they showed that the number of guns that were used in suicide rates across the U.S. and within New Jersey had not changed. So they, I think, correctly has come to the conclusion that when this law was passed, the number of guns that were used in homicides truly decreased related to this law. So now I'm going to hop into a study I'm very familiar with since I'm the first author. This is firearm legislation and firearm-related fatalities in the United States. And this is where we try to look at what is the role of all laws and do they affect fatalities. And we did this after this group of people who I work with had been looking at role of legislation around booster seats, around bicycle helmets, around seat belts, and do laws affect fatalities? And across all those areas, the answer was yes. So we said, well, what happens when you look at firearm legislation? So we looked at all the states' laws, and we divided the states into quartiles, where they had basically no laws, 0 to 2, quartile 1, versus quartile 4, where they had the most laws, up to 24 laws total. During this time period, 121,000 people died. 4 years, 121,000. This has been 33,000 people are dying every year related to firearms. 60% were suicides and 40% homicides. Overall, the rate of fatalities was 9.9 per 100,000. But here's what I want you to look at. Hawaii was 2.9. Louisiana, 18.0. What's the quick takeaway? Where you live matters. Where you live could be a six-fold difference in the fatality rates related to guns. On the x-axis, you've got this legislative strength score. How many laws do you have passed? And on the y-axis, you see the fatality rates per 100,000. And it's very clear. As the laws increase, the fatality rates go down. Now, the people always try to poke holes. They always try to understand. I'm in Chicago. There's a lot of laws in Illinois. What? It's not working here. Well, when the doctor says you've had a heart attack and you should take aspirin, it's going to decrease your risk of dying by 30%. It doesn't mean you're not going to die. It's going to decrease your rate, and that's an important thing to keep in mind. When you run the statistics, this is what we found. Overall, states with the most laws compared to those with the least had a 42% reduction in all firearm-related fatalities. When you break it down and you look exclusively at suicides, 37% reduction in firearm-related suicides. And when you look at homicides, it's a 40% reduction in firearm-related homicides. I will draw the conclusion, though we cannot prove the chicken and the egg, where you find states with the most laws, you can have states with the lowest fatality rates. This is kind of a map, in a way, that looks at the fatality rates where suicide is on the x-axis and homicide is on the y-axis. Those purple lines indicate the medians. So basically, you know, you want to be on the lower left corner to be in the states with the most successful rates of low suicides and homicides. The colors refer to how many laws there are. So down here, this is where you're going to see the preponderance of states that have the most laws. They're the states that have the lowest fatality rates both from suicide and homicide. And this is where you don't want to be. These are the places where you have both the highest homicide and the homicide rates. And you're going to notice those are the states that have the fewest laws. Why does this all come together? A priori, we thought that this probably has a relationship to household firearm ownership. And what we showed is that, yes, where there are more laws, there are lower ownership rates. And where there are lower ownership rates, there are lower fatality rates. And when we do this kind of model, it all came together. There's a lot of challenges to legislative studies. These are ecologic studies. We're taking data from multiple places and trying to combine it to understand it. There's time frame. When you pass a law, how long is it going to take till it has an effect? It may be years before you see that. These time series analyses often look at a single state, and so it's hard to really understand what's happening in the rest of the country. This is key. There are 310 million guns in the United States, one for every man, woman, and child in the U.S. These are durable items. We could ban all guns tomorrow except for the ones that people own, and there's still a lot of guns around, so it takes time. There's enforcement of laws, there's matching of intent of law to data, and there's all these other trends. So we need to understand this in a much more profound way. So now I'm going to kind of quickly dive into clinical interventions to decrease unsafe exposure to firearms. This is the perception of the United States about safety of guns at home. And what you'll notice in 2000, only a third of people thought that having a gun in your house made it safer, and over half thought it was more dangerous. And those numbers have completely flipped. It's incredible the change in perception about this. Dr. Kellerman did an incredible study back in 1986 that looked at all gun fatalities in the United States in Seattle and looked at how people were dying and who was dying. And when it turns out, when you compared it to the self-protection, I did have a criminal break into my house and I shot and killed them. Unintentional deaths are greater, 1.3 is the relative risk. Homicide, a person killing their spouse or a friend, 4 times higher. Suicide, 37 times higher than killing that intruder. You're not safer with a gun in your house. When we look specifically at kids, roughly a quarter to a third of households of kids have firearms. And when we look at how they're stored. About half of them are stored in an unsafe fashion, either loaded or unlocked. Sometimes they're stored both loaded and unlocked. But parents think that the kids can tell the difference between these guns and they won't touch them. And in reality is, kids actually know where the guns are. Kids less than 10 years of age, 3/4 of them know where guns are stored, and over 1/3 of them had handled weapons. And for the most part, parents did not know that. There's a fascinating study that put kids in a room, boys specifically. There's a chest in this room with 3 drawers, 2 water pistols, very clear water guns, and 1 real gun. It's obviously designed not to be fired, but to know somebody tried to pull the trigger. Within 15 minutes, 72% had discovered the guns. 3/4 of that group had handled it, and 1/2 of them had pulled the trigger, usually one boy pointing it at another. Pew, pew. Parents had no idea that the kids would be interested in it, and almost all of these boys had been trained about not touching guns. So, counseling families, does it work? There was an intervention at a family practice that looked at 127 families who have firearms, and there were 3 groups. The doctors were asked to read the simple thing. Having a loaded or unlocked gun in your house increases the risk of injury or death to family members, whether by accident or on purpose. I urge you to store unloaded guns in a locked drawer or cabinet and out of reach of children. Fairly simple intervention. Here's what they found. In the control group, 1/3 had made safe changes 2 months later, and 1/3 had made unsafe changes. In the verbal group, 2/3 had made a safe change. They were storing the guns in a safe way. And only 22% had made an unsafe change. And it didn't make a difference if they gave written material. So I think this clearly shows, and this has been shown in a couple of other studies, that you can improve the way people are storing it. So I'm going to conclude with this. I'm a Jewish pediatric ER doctor. For the last 16 years, I've worked Christmas Day. And last year, this is what happened. This 7-year-old boy was brought into my emergency room from Vermont, and you can see that bullet entry wound in his shoulder. And the arrow's not pointing to the right place, so let me show you. You see that? That's the pellet lodged into the myocardium, right next to his heart, physically there. And the story is this. His 9-year-old cousin had found this pellet gun. They assumed it was not loaded, and he pointed at his cousin as they played cops and robbers. Pew! He lived. He absolutely lived. He was within a millimeter of death. This was an unintentional thing. The family never thought it would happen. I'm going to recommend we need a 5-prong approach to reducing this. 1, we need to improve our legislation and have it consistent across the entire U.S. If you live in a state like Illinois where there are good laws and you are surrounded by states where there are no laws, it doesn't help as much as it should. We need to reinstate consumer regulation. It is ridiculous that teddy bears and cars are regulated, but guns are not. We need to have data collected and available. FARS is a national database of every single fatality by a car in the United States, which we can study and understand how to improve this. We need the same with guns. We need to fund research, and we need to screen and counsel our patients before we have to treat them. Thank you very much.
Now we have some time for questions. I will ask if you do have a question, raise your hands, and then when I call on you, please come to the front. So do we have any questions for our speakers? Here. Or if you can use your outside voice. Charges
minors, and they're not allowing for change to happen. And this guy was so angry at me because he said, "How dare you? My nephew was killed, and I can't believe it." And it was everything. I mean, I have spent my entire life working in violence prevention, and I've stood, you know, over more dead children than I've ever been able to remember. It's not that I don't take it seriously, it's that it's not, that's the challenge, is that we need to reclaim our connection to each other as people, because ultimately we belong to each other. I mean, it's really just a simple fact. If you don't own that, if you don't own that coming, then we're not going to get over where we need to go.
Can I also say something? There's a lot of times whether a young person is a victim or the shooter is happenstance, right? It's the same risk factors, the same community factors, the same kind of family circumstances that lead young people to vote. And we dehumanize the victims, too. And so I think that we have to be better as a city and a country of not treating, in particular, young men of color like they don't have to very explicitly say they do matter.
Additional questions? Right here. Mm-hmm.
Aspects of that. Why do people have guns in their home? somebody has got to address this wanting good. And I'm not sure how to do it, but legislation to say you may not have guns, you may not have loaded guns, parked running around the house. That's good. We can't do without that. We need more of that. So that people pick up the newspaper and say, oh, I shouldn't have had that.
So there already is like a good amount of evidence that having a gun in the home really increases the risk of everybody in the home, and that evidence slowly has to get out. It's the same way in terms of there was evidence about how smoking was so dangerous for people, and people just didn't believe it for a long time. And it took a while. It took lots of studies and more studies and lots of people pushing the information, and that's what I think we really need to see in the firearm area. I mean, I think, for example, one place where the evidence is just so overwhelming is that a gun in the home increases the risk for suicide in the United States. We have a dozen case control studies, we have a dozen ecological studies, we have psychological information about why this is true, and the evidence is overwhelming. And one of the things I would like to see, if we were a reasonable country, is for the Surgeon General to have a reasonable report to say, what do we know about guns in the home and suicide? And I think the evidence would speak.
Other questions? Yes.
Yeah, I was wondering if you guys have recommendations for working on the very local level. I live in a suburb south of here, and we're safe, we don't have a lot of crime. How can we talk to our local legislators, to work on prevention in the first place? Or are they kind of powerless against something way
or on guns specifically?
Yeah. Talking about, guns and how can we, come up with some kind of communications program in our community to work on preventing these incidents.
One of the things which would be incredibly helpful is if there's a way for various communities to get together and push to make it so that data were available, which it should be because it's collected, about where every gun used in crime actually comes from, which gunshots they come from, and then for people to put pressure on legislators to do something about these specific gunshots or to really regulate these gunshots better, because you can say, oh, my community is perfectly safe, but it turns out your gun shop is supplying guns to criminals in other areas, and that gun shop is making money on it. I mean, I'm from Boston, and I can tell you, the large majority of guns used by criminals in Boston come from outside of Massachusetts. And we can't find out right now which gun shops those are. But basically, if we could, then there are, for example, religious groups in our community, religious groups in those communities who could really try to do something to make sure that doesn't happen. There's a study done by one of our students from Jamaica that found out that over 80% of guns used in Jamaica crime came from three counties in Florida.
I think the other piece of it is to talk about suicide. So you mentioned that you live not far from Chicago. Right?
Yeah.
So in Illinois, you would think that the discussion about guns is only about homicide and only about Chicago, right? We have about 50% more suicides in Illinois than homicides. And the majority of those suicides occur with a firearm, right? And we don't talk about that, and the more available guns are, the higher gun suicide is. And so I think recognizing that there are pieces of this that happen, in the smallest, most rural part of the state, it's not just a Chicago issue.
And indeed, the evidence shows that basically gun death is pretty evenly distributed across rural, suburban, and urban areas. It's just different types of gun death.
And basically, if you look across the 50 states, if you remove firearms, the suicide attempt, the suicide fatality rate is essentially the same across all states. What differentiates states, and there is an enormous difference in fatality rates from suicide, it's all about gun ownership. And so, the state story, removing them from the house is one thing, but, local legislature is requiring that you have safe storage of them, preventing especially kids from getting access. would undoubtedly have a significant effect on the fatality of suicides. You know, you take away the most lethal means, you attempt to kill yourself using a gun, the success rate is about 85 to 90%. When you go to pills, which is the second most common approach to this, the success rate is about 2%. It's a major difference. And when people survive from a suicide attempt, the likelihood that they will go on to kill themselves is actually very, very low. So it's all about having the ability to have regret, which there is no ability for people to pull the trigger.
There's a question over here.
Hi. I'm from Canada, and all this is very foreign for me. when I see your death rate from the gun, I believe it's skyrocketing. And I was wondering, and I'll ask a very naive question. To go around the second census, you have to have up to 24 months to get your guns and maybe the injury stuff. So why is this so difficult to change the constitution?
One of the things to recognize is that the Constitution basically was changed by the interpretation of the 5-4 Heller case, where up until 10 years ago, individuals did not have a right to own guns. But right now, you know, it's all the Second Amendment, according to the Supreme Court, guarantees is that individuals have a right to currently have a handgun in the house. That's all. And there's a right for legislators to pass all sorts of laws regulating guns, as long as you don't take away the basic right, which is now a 10-year right, to own basically a handgun in the home. So there's huge numbers of things one could do besides changing the Constitution, which for any issue is incredibly hard to change in this
way. But even beyond that, we don't need to change the Constitution. You know, the idea that there would be unregulated cars without speed limits, without registration, without purchasing, without emission things, would be insane. We would never think about doing that. I don't think we need to change the Constitution. We just need to be more thoughtful about how we kind of have guns in our country.
There are a lot of social media words for left-wing or something that, you know, go viral.
Source for data.
And I think as public health professionals, it's incumbent upon us to be using data as part of this discussion. And so the two resources I would suggest for that are David's website and the Johns Hopkins website. It doesn't have to be a complex, overwhelming data argument. They have stuff on their website where you can get factoids, but they're based on field data, not the research.
Time for one last question in the back.
This is more of a comment, kind of related to the last person. I think it's one of the kind of closing for this conference. I think it's great when you talk about gun violence in a room full of public health professionals and social scientists and medical professionals. And we talked about wanting to expand this information via the internet, but
Thank you, everyone.
I think, really quickly, I think a piece of the science that some of our policymakers in particular are more receptive to is around the economics. I don't know. I know it's not Ted Miller in here. I don't know if he
left,
right?
Left.
But there are policymakers who may not be receptive to ideas about saving lives, but they're receptive to ideas about saving dollars. I mean, that's disturbing. But sometimes we have to meet people where they are. And so there are people like Ted who are doing great work on the economic benefits of reducing
them. I want to thank everyone for attending. We're at 2 o'clock, and I want to thank our panel again for an incredible session.